When it comes right down to it, we all have a bit of a muscophobia in us, and therein lies a problem. When we see that rats have invaded our environs, we freak out and run for the rat poison. While the rat poison kills rats, it also kills all the creatures that that prey on those rats, which means there will soon be ever more rats to poison. This muscophobia merry-go-round leads us to ask, can we control pests without poisons?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 731st edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Brisbane who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Good morning.
Folks, few things evoke more fear and loathing in we humans than the sight of dirty rats slinking about our home and environs. And so when we do see those dirty rats slinking about, we do the obvious, which is we run for the most powerful poison we can find. But when we use those powerful poisons to kill the dirty rats, we also kill the creatures that prey upon them, including barn owls, bobcats, coyotes, foxes, hawks, kestrels, and scores of other predators and scavengers. When the creatures that prey on the rats have been poisoned out of business, there will be an ever greater population of dirty rats slinking about us. And so today we pause to ask, can we control pests without poisons? Here to help us explore that question today, we have Stella McMillan, who is the environmental scientist for the California Department of Fish and Game. Stella, welcome. Oh, gosh. There it is. Stella, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, thank you. It's nice to be on.
Yep. Well, look, fortunately, we have engineer Nikki James with us today, so to help us press the right knobs, and we finally got the right one pressed. So you're an environmental scientist. What on earth is an environmental scientist?
An environmental scientist, well, I work for the Department of Fish and Game, and my job is to study the impacts of pesticides on fish and wildlife in California. And as part of that, actually probably my biggest pesticide issue right now in California is rodenticide use. And as you mentioned before, we're finding widespread exposure of raptors and predators from the rat poisons used by residential users in California. And by widespread exposure, I'm talking about like 75% of raptors, mountain lions, coyotes, pretty much you name it. If it's a predator or a scavenger and we've looked for it, we've found the rodenticides in their tissues.
Wow, that's a huge percentage. Well, you're an environmental scientist with the California Department of Fish and Game. That must mean you're a government employee, so the taxpayers are paying your way, right?
Absolutely. Yes, they're paying my way, and they're also paying for all the chemical analysis we have to do to study this problem.
So it seems like a good use of our taxpayer funds. I like the idea that there's somebody there watching out.
But I think it's a good use.
So also with us today, we have Thomas Whitman of Gophers Limited. Thomas, welcome to the Food Chain. Welcome back to the Food Chain.
Good morning, Michael, and good morning, Stella.
Good morning.
Gophers Limited.
Well, Gophers Limited is a company that I started probably about 15 years ago, and my mission is to provide people alternatives to using poisons. And I work with all animals. Primarily, the focus is on ground burrowing animals like gophers and moles and voles. But I work with any problem anyone calls me about.
So not just rats, but just about everything.
Just about everything. Although I spent 15 years working on rats when I worked at the University of California, and I kind of avoid them now if I can.
Well, let's start with a big question here, Stella. Probably start with you. Why do we hate rats so much? Why there is this actual phobia, musophobia, in which some people actually have a fear, an irrational fear of rats, but the rest of us just hate them.
Right, and I don't know if I can answer the question of why we hate them. I mean, there's, you know, the historical carrying disease and things like that, and just the association with dirtiness and poor hygiene and things like that. So I would imagine that's part of what's going on.
Tom?
Well, like Stella said, they have really poor hygiene.
They do.
They are dirty. I mean, the way that you track a rat into a house or a building is by the kind of smut trail they leave, because they don't clean their fur like other animals. And also they dribble urine wherever they go. So
they're filthy.
They are kind of filthy, and they're very invasive.
And, of course, our history of rats is none too pleasing as well. It goes back to the great bubonic plague, the Black Death. We finally trace that to the fleas carried by rats. And throughout our history in agriculture, we've always been faced with the fact that rats get into our grain supply and contaminate it and destroy it
by
their filth. So there's plenty of reason why we should not like the rats and even come to hate them. And then, of course, there is the phobia of them, which is an entirely different thing. But we actually do hate them. And so whenever we see them, we run for the poison, right, Stella?
Absolutely. It looks like that happens, you know, all too often. And as a consequence of this, and as using particularly potent poisons, we're seeing, you know, our solution for killing rats ending up in other wildlife that we actually are more fond of, like barn owls and things like that.
What does our phobia or our hatred of rats prevent us from actually thinking things through? I just think of myself, and I remember when my daughter was very young, a baby, and I spotted a whole bunch of rats that had moved in out back in the wood pile. And, you know, I had a baby, and I just went straight for the poison. And I suspect that that's what most people do. They don't even think. They just run for the whatever that will take care of the problem as soon as possible.
Right, and that is part of the problem, I think, is some of the best solutions are more long-term solutions, like, you know, ceiling entrances and things like that, so they can't get into your house. However, those do take some time. And, yeah, the feeling is kind of you need to solve this problem immediately.
Is that what happens with your customers as well, Thomas? When they see rats, they run for the poison?
Well, they run for the poison, and then sometimes they are not effective, and then they call me and they say, well, what can I do? And like Stella says, the first thing I tell them is find out how they're getting into your house. But I actually deal with rats in agriculture a lot, too, where they will eat certain trees and clip them off. They'll eat seedlings. And so I have to deal with rats out in the environment, too. And when people use poisons in that environment, then there's a really big problem.
With respect to those
secondary poisoning,
yeah.
Or unintentional poisoning of other animals.
Stella, do rats develop a resistance to the poisons that we poison them with?
Yeah, there has been some evidence of certain, the older products we had, there was some resistant issues, which is why they came up with some of the more potent chemicals that we're having bigger issues in. So, yeah, there has been a history of that.
What would my grandfather have used for rats?
Probably warfarin.
Warfarin.
Right, and there is some resistance.
And now that, of course, has become something that many humans consume to thin their blood for high blood pressure, right?
Right, yeah, I think a relative of warfarin.
Weird that would come to be, but that is what came to be. So the grandparents used warfarin. And did the rats become immune to that or resistant to it?
Yeah, there was some resistance with warfarin. And the other thing with warfarin is you have to feed it to the rodents several times. And some of the newer poisons, their advertising slogan is that it's a single feeding. And so that's more desirable for the residential user to have a single feeding rather than having to feed them repeatedly.
Yeah, rather than wait around, you want to see the rats dead right away.
Well, although still with the single feeding, it still takes them, you know, 3 to 5 days to die. So it's a single feeding, but then they're around, running around with poison in their bodies for 3 to 5 days for predators to get.
We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to ask you, has anybody ever measured how much rat poison we're putting into our environment. Because if given the amount I use to get rid of those rats, I assume that people are using a lot of it around, and what impact does that have on our environment? This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. We're talking rats today, those dirty rats that freak us all out. So we run for the poison. But what happens when we poison rats? Today we're looking at what happens to with the consequence of those actions, and we will be right back. So do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, what do you do when you see those dirty rats slinking about your house? Well, if you're anything like me, and probably 90% of everybody else, you run for the poison, right? Going to get those, kill those dirty rats before they take over our environment and endanger the lives of us and our families. So it's what we do. But what happens when we do that? What happens when we put all of these poisons onto our environment? Stella McMillan, as a environmental scientist with the California Department of Fish and Game, you look at this. Do you have any idea about how much poison we're using in our environment to control rats?
I don't. You know, there's sales figures. We don't keep good track of homeowner use, which is what we need to keep track of to know how many people are putting things out there. But I do know just from judging the wildlife exposure, it's way too much. We've got 70% of our raptors and other predators showing up with the anticoagulant rodenticides in their bodies. So definitely looking at wildlife, we are using too much of this and not keeping it on target, which is on the rodents.
Well, so this is what you do. Your job, Stella McMillan, essentially is to track down the consequence of our actions. Is that a fair assessment?
Right.
How do you do that?
We do it several different ways. One way is we'll have a barn owl chick come in the other day from a rehab center, and the chick had been just sitting there kind of lethargic on the sidewalk, and the rehab had tried to rehabilitate it, but it died, and it came in, and it just was obvious that it had been exposed to anticoagulants. It was just exposure to anticoagulants means that the animal bleeds internally mm-hmm. and externally, and it was just kind of a big bloody mess. And so that's one of the ways, is a rehab center. Someone turns in the animal, and then sometimes we do monitoring studies. For example, we looked at San Joaquin kick foxes in Bakersfield and found that a huge percentage of those had anticoagulants in them.
What percentage?
I believe it was 79%.
79%. How do you measure that?
You take out their livers and send mm-hmm. them into the lab.
So those, the ones that you do see that are dead, you do necropsies on, right?
Exactly. So most of them are road kills or, mm-hmm. you know, something like that. And so you just take the ones that are dead and send in their livers.
What does it look like when you do a necropsy on an animal that's obviously had these anticoagulants? What do their insides look like?
It's just very obvious. First, before you even open them up, sometimes you can see that under their skin there's just bloody, pulpy mass. And then you open them up, and in their chest cavity, for example, they've bled out. So what an anticoagulant does is it prevents clotting. And so the animal, you know, something that would have just given them a little scrape before mm-hmm. causes them to bleed to death. So you can just see an abundance of blood, and then nothing to explain the blood, no broken ribs or anything like that. So it's not caused by a car injury. It's just caused by the lack of clotting of their blood.
Sure, and when we're talking about anticoagulants, we're talking about warfarin, right?
And actually the products we're having more problems with are products such as Brodifacoum and Bromodialone, and those are newer products and more toxic than warfarin.
And these products are available to the home and garden market?
Yeah, they're available over the counter.
Mm-hmm. So we see the rats when we run down to the home and garden store and we say, give me the most powerful thing you can.
Exactly.
And we take it out and we kill the rats. But the rats just don't die right away, do they?
They don't. It takes them 3 to 5 days to die. So in that amount of time, and these are formulated to give them a lethal dose, the first dose, mm-hmm. but they've still got 3 to 5 days to eat. So they'll continue to eat the poison and be running around with just a massive dose of the poison in them and available to be eaten by hawks or coyotes
sure.
or kid foxes or whatever.
And so since they're poisoned and dying and they're probably losing their survival instincts too, so that means they're probably running around in the middle of the day where they otherwise would be hiding about or slinking about at night.
Right, and they're weakened, so they're not as able to escape predators.
And thus the predators find them easy prey, and there they are. We're all of a sudden, what we started, you know, with rats is now in our food chain and working its way up the food chain. So you actually look at these animals, and you found this incredible percentage of these animals have been poisoned, essentially, by eating poisoned rats.
Right, and more often, we don't find a lot that show the obvious signs of poisoning. More often, we take something that was hit by a car that looks actually normal, and you send in that liver, and that's been exposed, too. So something, you know, even animals that show no sign of poisoning at all have a huge percentage of anticoagulant exposure.
And we're talking about a huge percentage, too. You did a study with bobcats from Los Angeles area?
Right. That was actually Seth Riley that did that study. And, gosh, I don't have the number of bobcats.
90%?
I know for mountain lions, they had from 2005 to present, and this is all over the state, they got 104 mountain lions, and 82 of those 104 had anticoagulants in them. So just a huge amount, and this is mountain lions, and so this isn't, this is an animal that most of us are pretty interested in protecting.
So you're seeing, this is really incredible, you're seeing this mind-numbing statistic about our wildlife being poisoned by rat poison. What are you doing as a scientist?
As a scientist, we are trying to get regulations changed. So there has been the EPA has been working on it, and they're working to restrict these so that they won't be available over the counter. And we're trying to in California beef up those regulations so that they're even stronger in California. That's what we're hoping to do.
Mm-hmm. And will they still be available on a commercial basis to like commercial agriculture?
Agriculture right now doesn't use the most toxic of products.
This isn't really an agriculture problem.
This isn't agriculture. This is basically residential users. And it's funny because agriculture, in some ways, we have an easier time regulating agriculture. We have a better way of like getting a hold of them and mm-hmm. informing them. Homeowners, not so much. And so this has been a homeowner problem. And we have not done a good job of educating homeowners, and so what it looks like we're going to need to do is just get the materials not available for your non-qualified applicator.
Sure, and I think that with respect to most homeowners are probably animal lovers when it gets right down to
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. You show them this information, and they absolutely are horrified that they could have anything to do with the problem.
And because they don't really think that they're causing any problem, because all they're doing is killing rats, right?
Right.
Okay, so we got a significant problem then. And with respect to educating the public, how on earth do you do that? I guess a show like this will help a little bit here and there.
That's right, and occasionally the press will get a hold of this and will, you know, do a story. There was a story in the Sacramento Bee a while ago, and that was helpful. We have not done a good job of reaching mm-hmm. homeowners. We've done a good job reaching agriculture and reaching the qualified applicators, but not your typical homeowner use.
Well, you know, I suppose we can educate the homeowner of the consequence of their action. I suppose we can pass laws that take the, you know, these tough new poisons out of the hands of homeowners. But that still doesn't solve the homeowner's problems of what to do with all those dirty rats, right?
Right.
So what do you recommend in along those lines?
Well, you know, the first thing I would mention, I would recommend is an approach, more of a long-term approach, where they're, you know, modifying the environment so that the rats aren't able to get inside and aren't able to cause trouble, take away food source, things like that.
Okay, so well, we're going to pick that up. We're going to take a quick break, but that's going to be where we go next is how we can control pests without poisons. Because, folks, our poisons are not only killing our pests, but they're killing just about everything else, or so it would seem. 79% of the San Joaquin Valley kit foxes show signs of being poisoned by rat poison and rodent poison. 90% of the bobcats living in and around the Los Angeles basin are showing have these poisons in their liver. But that's not all. There's the hawks, there's the coyotes, there's everything else that feeds on these animals that we kill. So we do have a responsibility here, it would seem, for our environment, and so that's what we're going to be talking about, how to do it without poisons when we get back. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, when it comes right down to it, we all have a fear and loathing of rats. When we see them slinking about our home or environs, we do what seems to be the natural thing to do. We run and get poison. And the more powerful poison, the better it is, by golly, because we're out to take care of those rats. But in taking care of those rats and poisoning those rats, we also poison the critters that predate upon those rats, that prey upon them. And now we're poisoning so many rats that that poison is becoming ubiquitous in our wildlife. Gosh, what 90% of the bobcats in the Los Angeles basin have poison, this rat poison, in their systems. So what on earth are we going to do about it? Are we going to continue poisoning rats until we essentially destroy all the wildlife in our world? Or is there an alternative? Are there other alternatives? That's a subject we're exploring today. With us, we have Stella McMillan, who is an environmental scientist for the California Department of Fish and Game. And Stella has been looking into the wildlife, the impact that poison has had on our wildlife, and the numbers that she's coming up with are truly extraordinary. Also with us today, Thomas Whitman from Gophers Limited. Thomas has been working with pests of all kinds for many years, and he specializes in controlling pests without poison. Thomas, we don't just use poison for rats, do we? We use poison for all kinds of critters.
Well, yes. I mean, poison is a very cold approach to controlling an animal. You don't have to see the animal or interact with the animal. You just put the poison out, and hopefully the animal goes away. It's a modern, quote, modern way of dealing with it. And so we poison everything that bothers us if we can.
Like? Besides rats?
Oh, yeah. Well, out in the garden, we poison gophers and moles and voles. Whatever seems to be the problem, people will usually try poison first.
Try poison first because it's the easiest and coldest, as you say, way to deal with it.
Right.
And Stella McMillan, we're talking a little bit about how it's really the homeowners of California and the world that are really causing this problem. It's not really agriculture. Agriculture is manageable because you can find farmers and get to them, but homeowners are not so easy to manage. Why is that? Why are homeowners the difficult part of this equation?
Well, they're harder to reach, and they're also typically farmers are more experienced in using different materials, and I mean it's their job to handle pests in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And they realize that a pesticide label is actually sort of a legal agreement. You must use that pesticide according to the label, or you're breaking the law. And I don't think homeowners necessarily get that. So, you know, a little is good, a lot is even better. They don't really worry about using it for the right pest sometimes. they're just a lot more less by the book. And I'm not saying that every farmer uses every pesticide correctly, but I think homeowners are a lot less likely to take it seriously.
Yeah, there's probably an economic component in farmers' use of pesticides, too. The stuff is expensive.
You know,
whereas a homeowner is probably thinking, well, I can buy that and get rid of those problems right away and not even think about it. But when you're a farmer, you're always working with dollars and cents, and it might have a different impact on how you think as well. Let me ask you this, Stella McMillan, as an environmental scientist with the Department of Fish and Game here in California. What would happen if we continue this use of a poison to get rid of rats, and then we end up getting rid of all of the animals that prey on rats? What's going to happen to the rat population?
Well, you would have definitely an explosion in the rodent populations if you got rid of predators. And you know, we don't necessarily know the consequences of what we're finding. So we see widespread exposure, and we don't necessarily know what that means. We don't know, does that mean that they're having smaller litters? We don't really know. I personally don't like it. I don't think that our wildlife should be exposed in that high of numbers to rodenticides. But we don't exactly know what it means right now.
So when you find animals, or 80-90% of the animals that prey on rats have these rat poisons in their systems, you know something's not quite right, and you just don't know what impact that is going to have on their ability to reproduce and to continue their species. Right,
or is their susceptibility to disease, or maybe the reason why, you know, we find these getting hit by cars is because they're getting slowed down by the poison. We just don't know.
Don't have the slightest idea then. But what is happening is that we are poisoning those animals that prey on rats. And so if we continue this and get rid of all of those animals, the rat population, of course, is going to explode, which means we're going to need all that much more poison in our environment. So this is merry-go-round of craziness here that we appear to be involved in. Is there a way off? How do we get off the merry-go-round? Let's start with you, Stella. You talked about the environment. What do we need to do to our environment?
Well, you know, we need to, I think, just take a longer-term, more serious approach about this, and not just, kind of fly off the cuff and run and get the most potent poison available, but actually do things like habitat modification. There are, you know, rat poisons that are less harmful than others, so actually looking into what you can use that won't cause the same effects. Employing a professional, for example, Thomas, who has other tools in his tool belt besides poison, is a good way of going about solving the problem.
I don't think Thomas has any poison in his tool belt. Do you, Thomas?
No, actually, I'm certified green by the Monterey Bay Green Business Association.
No poisons. Let's go to the phone. Folks, if you have a question about rats, how to control pests, give us a call. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Michael Olson here. This is The Food Chain. Today we are talking with Stella McMillan, environmental scientist of the California Department of Fish and Game, and Thomas Whitman, who is the proprietor of Gophers Limited. We're talking about how to get rid of these pests without poison. We're going to go to Dan. Phone number is 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Dan, welcome to The Food Chain.
Hi, Michael. Thank you. I live right next to the forest. I have had problems with mice getting in my walls, but I fixed it. But
how did you fix that? You plug up the holes, right?
No.
Ah.
I tried and tried, but they're pretty tenacious. Well, one thing I did, I like to feed the birds black oil sunflower seeds. I now have them in a galvanized pail with a lid. But I got something that put out a high-frequency sound emitter from mail order, and it kept them out for... I had a severe problem, but that when they left, it kept them out for several years. But I came home one night, and it was emitting a noise, and I right after that, I noticed they were back, so I went to the hardware store, and I got one made in China. It was useless, and I went back... I went back and complained. I'm frustrated with stuff made in China that doesn't work. Anyway, Can I mention this product?
Sure, go ahead really quickly. We're on a break here.
It's called Insect and Rodent Control Equipment. It's made by Global Instruments LTD out of Trenton, Missouri. It was $49. They all left from inside my walls. It sends a high... the frequency it goes...
Okay, we're going to pick it up when we come back. Hold on, Dan.
Okay.
We will be right back with Stella McMillan and Thomas Whitman and Michael Olson and you. 800-624-2665, 831-47-1980. This is The Food Chain. Well, the same thing happened to me, Dan. I lived next to the woods, and the rats moved into my house, and there was a whole bunch of them, and they liked my house better than they liked living out in the woods, and I guess the same thing happened to you with respect to the mice. Quick question to Thomas Whitman. We were talking off the air about Project Purr. What is Project Purr, and how could that help a person like Dan who's living next to the woods?
Well, Project Purr is a local nonprofit that saves the lives of feral cats. And feral cats get trapped by them, and sometimes I'll get a job where I need to trap feral cats. And if we catch a litter of kittens, for example, or something like that, or some young cats, Project Purr will give them all their shots and bring them up to health and place them in people's homes or farms or ranches that live in rural areas or whatever, and the cats then become the main predator for the rats and mice. It's a simple way to save their lives and solve a problem.
Stella, what do you think is about approach like that, being a scientist and all?
I think that's great. And I think, you know, one thing that was brought up that I forgot to mention is just the diversity of methods that aren't poisons, such as mechanical traps and things like that, and, you know, biological control like a cat, perfect.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dan, did you try poison?
Yes, I'm very sad to hear that the anticoagulants are toxic to the owls and stuff. I did not know that till today. Like Decon, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I'm very sorry to have used that.
Well, and I guess that's what I used, too. And when I ran across this article about potent new rat poisons killing California wildlife, I thought, oh, my goodness. Our actions always have consequences beyond what we expect them to have. And this is one of them is particularly frightening, the notion that we'd be killing all of this beautiful wildlife in an attempt to get rid of the dirty rats. Thomas, you talked about how we can replace it. How, first of all, that there is around almost all commercial buildings there are bait stations.
Right. The classic approach, I guess you would say, to controlling rats in a commercial situation is to have these containers that hold poisons, and there's all various kinds, mostly anticoagulants. And, the rats go and feed on the poisons around it, and the pest control person just replenishes the supply every couple weeks. Well, you can, those bait stations also are made to fit snap traps. Sometimes those stations can fit as many as three traps in one station. So it does mean probably more visits by the pest control operator to clean the rats out of those traps.
Still, I sense something here. I sense that another reason we use poisons is simply because it's the easiest thing to do.
Definitely. Right. And the thing is, you know, the pest runs away and you never have to deal with its body, which is part of the problem mm-hmm. because its body is there.
But
with a trap, you actually have to get rid of its body.
Right.
So it's a neater solution to use the poisons, however, you know, more problematic to wildlife.
That is so true. But there are some traps now that are being designed, you know, build a better mouse trap, that don't... Unlike the classic mouse trap, where you have to actually pull the mouse or rat out of the trap, that are really easy to set and they're really easy to take the mm-hmm. the dead rat out of.
But you still have to tend these things. Whereas a poison in a commercial setting, you know, everybody's thinking about dollars and cents, and whoever's running the pest control has to, you know, you want them there a minimum amount of time. But if you're actually tending these traps, that takes more time than coming by once every week and dumping more poison into the system.
Right. Well, that's all part of being responsible.
Right.
I mean, I work a lot in the more rural situations with farms and farmers. And, for example, I have some vineyards that have switched from using poisons for ground squirrels and gophers. I mean, ground squirrels are a huge, huge place where poisons are being used right now, especially in agriculture, and gophers.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had people using systems that I've developed for really effective mechanical trapping actually switch out of using the poisons. In fact, I have one vineyard that's 30,000 acres that was able to switch from using poisons to mechanical trapping. So it's possible, and if people are feeling
so
responsible, the options are there.
Okay, thank you very much for that call, Dan. Really appreciate it. Let's go quickly to Rick. Rick, welcome to the food chain.
Hi. I just wanted you guys to mention to everyone that these poisons are highly toxic to our pets. Also, an animal could be eaten by a dog or a cat, and it would kill the dog or cat.
Stella, any indication that these poisons are finding their way into our domestic pet population?
Definitely. That is definitely a problem that that veterinarians see regularly, and I think actually the original intent, one of the big intents of the EPA regulating these materials had to do with domestic animals and kids as much as it did, or more than it did with wildlife.
Domestic animals and kids?
Right. Well, kids can get into these things, too, and some of them actually look pretty appetizing. Some of them look kind of like churros.
That's true. That's true. I've had people call me that where some bait was accidentally left on the surface, and the bait is bright green. It's like a kid just grabs it.
What are churros?
A churro, you know, like the Mexican pastry.
They look like candy.
But yeah, I mean, not. I mean, nothing. They don't look like natural candy. They look like bright green churros. But you know, kids might be attracted to that, and so. So that was one of the motivations in regulating them, was to protect kids.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. Right back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have so much to talk about in so little time. Stella McMillan, as an environmental scientist for the California Department of Fish and Game, can we control pests without poison?
Definitely.
How?
We can, first of all, do just the basic habitat modification.
Mm-hmm. Cleanup.
Cleanup, food supply, prevent access to your house or wherever you don't want them to be. And then there's mechanical means, you know, mechanical traps, things mm-hmm. like that. And those two things should be the first things you go to. And especially the habitat modification is a long-term solution. So it'll, you know, fixing those things will prevent you from having problems in the future, whereas poison, you're going to have to keep doing the same thing year after year.
Thomas Whitman, Gophers Limited, you're an expert at trapping animals and getting rid of them. You're an expert at the hardware of traps. And yet, when you teach somebody how to do this, do they actually do it themselves? Can they actually do it themselves, or do they call on you to come and trap the rat?
Oh, no. I like to give people alternatives, and I like to empower people to know what the alternatives are and how to use them. And, you know, a really good example is people that have chickens. Mm-hmm. Anyone that has chickens has tons of rats. And so things they can do around a chicken coop that'll stop the rat population from building up so much that they end up in your house is not overfeeding their chickens or not leaving a chicken feed around, because rats just love chicken feed. There are certain traps you can use that
are... So my neighbors have chickens now, which means?
You'll have rats.
Nice.
As simple as that. I have some multiple catch rat traps that I like. But, you know, in terms of the easiest rat trap you can build and a very selective one, if you go to YouTube and you just put in the search in YouTube, bucket trap, I mean, you just have like a small bucket of water, and there's so many variations of this trap, but you just like put a stick across it with a tin can that has peanut butter on it, and a ramp up to the bucket, and the rats just try to lick the peanut butter off the can, fall in the bucket, and drown. And it's very easy.
Huh, I'm gonna try that. It's called the bucket trap.
Just go to YouTube and put rats and bucket trap.
So then we can get rid of the rat and not kill the raptors.
Exactly. And there's only a rat would go into that trap.
Wow. Any other good tricks like that?
Well, I've worked with a lot of people in designing rat-proof areas.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of concrete and steel. And even then... So it's more a matter of management rather than...
So it's really, to manage rats, you just have to be a manager. You have to be there managing it, right? It's as simple as that. See, if you don't manage them, you have to poison them. And when you poison them, you destroy your environment. So there really is no alternative, folks.
That's exactly right. You have to manage the problem because it's not going to go away.
Stella?
Yes.
How do we get in touch with you folks if we need to get information?
Well, the Department of Fish and Game has a good website, and I would start there. They've actually got our rodenticide press release, which has all the information I gave you,
mm-hmm.
and you know some of those chemical names in case you can't remember them. So you go to Department of Fish and Game, dfg.ca.gov, and put in the search, put rat or rodent, and you'll get it.
All right. Thank you, Stella. McMillan, Thomas Whitman, how do we get in touch with Gophers Limited?
Well, I have an educational website. It's gopherslimited.com. And I give a lot of lectures and talk about rats, and you can see my lecture notes on my website, too.
There you go.
Gopherslimited.com.
Thank you all for tuning in. This has been The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.